Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to this week's episode of Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name's Kirk Chisholm, and I'm going to be your host. So today, we are interviewing Will Rind. How are you doing today, Will?
Very well, Kirk. How are you?
Good. So we wanted to bring Will on because Will has a background in many different areas in finance, ETFs and gold specifically, which are areas that I know a lot of people have an interest in hearing about. Will, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background to start so people know where you're coming from?
I'm from Scotland. I'm from a town called Aberdeen, which is the northeast part of Scotland. I got started in investing with a Japanese investment bank just after college called Nomura, and then made my way into the asset management business. And I sort of got involved in ETFs because I was working for a company at the time, which folks will now know as BlackRock. But we really were doing the first ETFs in the world. And so launching ETFs at that time, it was in Europe, but really it was a new product category in the market. And so I started doing that and then really sort of dedicated my career from that point up until now to these investment products and to the industry of ETFs. So from there, I got involved in a startup, which became very successful, that was sort of largely focused in the commodity sector. And then just actually before this, I was the CEO at the largest gold fund in the world, the ETF called GLD. And then I left and set up my own company, Granite Shares. And that's what I've been doing for the last 3 years. But again, we're focused on ETFs, exchange-traded products.
So you've got a good bit of background in ETFs, and I want to kind of touch on each of them. I know gold is of particular interest because it's obviously one of the few asset classes that's doing well right now. So I'm very curious in your background there. But maybe we can start by talking about kind of the ETF industry and how it's grown in the last few decades and kind of what you see as kind of the future for the industry.
You know, this has definitely been the fastest growing category within asset management. And really, when you think about it, you know, this was a new product 20 years ago. And still, there's a lot of people today that don't know about ETFs and don't know what they are. But, you know, that being said, they've become a multi-trillion dollar asset class globally. And I think the benefits of ETFs are really kind of straightforward. And in some respects, they're very relevant to other products and other services that people love across the globe, regardless of whether it's an investment or not, which is, you know, fundamentally, ETFs are about choice. And you know, when you think about the legacy mutual fund industry, you know, a lot of that was very limited. So limited to maybe, you know, large cap value, US equities or bonds. And really the product offering or the choice for consumers was pretty limited. And so one of the great things about ETFs is you can sort of buy whatever you want within that ETF fund construct. So you can buy obviously anything from US equities to individual countries all around the world, to obviously things like gold and different bond exposures. So I think fundamentally it's about choice, and consumers love choice. And the second thing, which is very relevant to, you know, whether it's supermarkets or other businesses these days that are thriving, it's about low cost. And I think these two things together are very compelling for people. So a lot of choice for customers at low prices. Plus, I think another thing that's relevant with all good businesses today, the consumer experience is very good. So they're easy to buy and sell. No paperwork's required. You don't need to worry about hidden fees or commissions. Be very tax efficient for people. So the experience is very good. And typically, you know, all you need is access to a brokerage account, which most people have already. And I think those things sort of in concert make it the compelling proposition that it is. And I think the market share, you know, this is a market that even now with, you know, well over $2 trillion in assets under management, still is growing at about 20-30% per annum, which is pretty phenomenal. And I think that goes to these benefits that I've talked about, but also that it is the new technology of investing. The mutual fund world is dying. People want the new technology. They want access to, you know, more choice at a lower cost. And that's why, you know, the ETF vehicle and the fund and the industry is winning.
You make it sound really compelling for ETFs, but if ETFs exist, why do mutual funds still exist if it's that compelling?
It's a story that is played out across the land in all sorts of different industries where it's not a zero-sum game. And it's particularly not in an industry like financial services or asset management, where we're probably the most highly regulated industry on the planet. And so within that comes a huge amount of friction, and that could be cost friction, it's tax friction. But basically, if you want to move from a mutual fund to an ETF, it's not like moving from one website to another, i.e. a zero friction transaction. There's cost involved. You could be realizing taxes, hidden capital gains or other taxable events. There's cost in terms of brokerage commissions, in terms of buying and selling. So there are legacy kind of issues, which means that, you know, this is definitely a long-term trend. This is not something that is going to happen overnight or has happened overnight. And I think there's one big thing that people perhaps should understand, which is that, you know, a big part of the mutual fund complex is in retirement accounts, which is 401ks. A lot of those 401ks are actually controlled by the very mutual fund companies that offer the underlying funds. And so clearly they are very hesitant to change that business model and open themselves up to competition. That is a shoe that will drop at one point, but clearly that is a big part of the market, which hasn't really changed. But anybody that owns a 401k wants access to lower cost investments, wants more choice. That will change over time. It's just not going to happen quickly.
I want to kind of dig in a little bit because I have a decent understanding about this, but a lot of these mutual fund companies also have ETFs. So why wouldn't they themselves push for ETFs in the 401k space when they have both mutual fund and ETFs? What's the nexus behind that?
Actually, very few of them do. If you think about all of the mutual fund companies out there, you're talking about a really small number that have an ETF offering, an even smaller number that have a significant ETF offering. So really, you're only talking about probably three or four firms that have anything like a considerable or a significant ETF offering. So clearly, for the vast majority of firms, they have been very reluctant to embrace ETFs because of the fear of cannibalizing their own business. Ironically, perhaps, the ones that have done, so for example, a BlackRock or an Invesco or a State Street, you know, have done very well. And I think it has been big value add to their business, but not everybody thinks that way. And so the vast majority of the traditional mutual fund firms, they don't have an ETF offering. That's something that they have been reluctant to do for the reasons that we state.
Let's kind of just take a step back here for a moment just to define it, because I know sometimes if terms can be confusing for people, but there are things like ETFs and ETNs. Can you describe the difference between the two just for kind of our listeners and what they actually mean?
The acronym ETF stands for Exchange Traded Fund. So really it's a fund that is listed on a stock exchange and therefore its shares can be bought and sold just as easily as buying shares of Apple. So instead of buying shares of Apple that has a ticker code and you're buying shares in the company, an ETF has the same ticker code, but instead of buying a share in a company, you're buying a share in a fund that owns multiple companies or multiple bonds or gold or something. So really, it's a fund that's listed on the exchange and the shares are able to be bought and sold on a daily basis in a brokerage account. Now, the difference between that and the ETN, the exchange traded note that stands for, is that a note is not technically a fund. It's actually a debt security that's issued by a bank. Typically, it's an investment bank that provides exposure to a particular underlying index, but it does that in the form of a derivative contract. So typically, you would have an ETN that gives exposure to something that you're not able to do easily within a fund format. A good example of that could be certain commodities, or it could be certain investments that need leverage. But either way, one is a fund, one is a debt security or a note. And otherwise, mechanically, they're sort of the same in terms of the ability to be bought and sold for our investors.
You know, I know there's a lot of recent trends in the ETF industry. It started with what, the diamonds and the spiders and the Qs? I think those are the first three, right?
Yep.
And then subsequently, there are others. But what are the trends now that people are looking for from the ETF space? Because there's been a talk of active versus passive, and there's the ETF space is really kind of ballooning up in how it's evolving. So can you kind of talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So I think let's call it the first 10 years. I would sort of liken to an old-fashioned land grab, where really it was about setting out as much choice, as much product as possible to kind of cover the map in terms of all sorts of different combinations of exposure. So whether that was equities, bonds, countries, et cetera. And then as the market sort of matured a little bit, I think the last 10 years have been more about response to the market environment or response to investors' needs. Two of the trends that have happened really in the last few years has been what people commonly refer to as smart beta. And smart beta is about indexing in a different way to market capitalization. And market capitalization means an index such as the S&P 500 or the Dow, where the weights of the companies within the index are determined by how big the companies are. So the biggest companies by market cap get the highest representation, smallest ones the lowest. And so a big thing has been to change that philosophy around and have an index weighted by either equally or according to certain factors, such as perhaps minimum or low volatility or dividend payers, et cetera. That's been a big thing. And then the last point, which you briefly mentioned, is we've never really had active ETFs in the traditional sense. ETFs, for the most part, have been purely index-based. And there's an argument to say that they're more active in the fixed income space, but generally what people would think of as being active, that hasn't really happened in the ETF space. And then now, I think that is something that we are starting to see. And part of that was about a regulatory change, which allowed a slightly different structure of ETF to come to market that enabled active managers to launch their active strategy in an ETF wrapper, but with less transparency than a traditional ETF. The logic behind that was that active managers were nervous that if they have the same transparency as a regular ETF, that their portfolios could be gamed by investors in the market. Now, whether that's true or not is for a different conversation, but suffice to say, you'll start to see actively managed ETFs coming to market, albeit with slightly different transparency than your traditional index ETF.
I haven't seen a whole lot of, when you say active versus passive, even a lot of the quote unquote active ones are, a lot of them I've seen have been like quant based or algorithm based. They're not individuals who are buying and selling stocks based on their opinion, you know, or research like mutual funds are. Do you see that as becoming more of a trend now that that change has been made?
In the ETF world, I would say, look, I think in the industry more broadly, that's been a huge change. And what people think of as traditional active management, which is, like you said, an individual stock picking, buying and selling stocks, that's largely gone away because it hasn't worked. And consistently over time, active managers or human beings have not been able to consistently outperform the market, you know, certainly after fees and taxes. And so the other thing which clearly has been driving a lot of change in the industry has been, like most industries, but the proliferation of technology and information and any kind of edge that an individual once had, you know, I'm talking potentially decades ago, has now been eroded by just the speed of information and the access that everybody has really to the same kind of information. And so that's eroded a lot of advantage for the human stock picker. And has led to a lot more data intense strategies, which is basically that's quantitative investing and any kind of rules-based investing, but very much sort of data-driven, scientific, principle-based investing. And that's, you know, really been very popular over the last few years because it's designed to take away the human element, which, you know, hasn't really worked over time.
I'm curious because I've seen this trend of, you know, around the same time that the ETF trend started, also happened to be a big trend in indexing. I think it was around 2008 when people got frustrated because MPT didn't work. It didn't matter what you were investing in, you lost a lot of money. We started to see this trend go in the direction of the ETFs around then because people just said, well, why am I trying to pick stocks when I can just buy the index and make it easy? Mm-hmm. And I wonder if too many people index, is that causing a problem in the system where, you know, before, decades ago, you had managers who were buying and selling stocks and you were they were making informed decisions. But now people are just shoving money in into an index and hoping that that's the best approach, which of course rewards the winners. The largest companies end up getting rewarded the most. Do you see that creating a problem down the road, or how do you look at that?
I don't really see it creating a problem, because what we've got is a proliferation of multiple indices. So I think if it was just one index, you know, in other words, if the industry was just boiled down into one index and it was everybody was investing in this one index, then of course, at some point, you would have the ability, or you'd have a, you know, a strong probability of affecting the market. But throw into that thousands of indexes, you have more indexes than ETFs, and you have people buying and selling those on a daily basis, and certainly very, very frequently, then you have a market that still has price discovery, just like everything else. I think there's certainly areas of the market, perhaps, that if they get too overloaded, just like anything else, by certain investment strategies, that can affect the underlying market. But that's no different to, you know, mutual fund or mutual funds that own the same small cap stocks, or, you know, some area of the market which just gets overbought and therefore people are overexposed to a certain sector. But I think broadly speaking, you know, ETFs, they've been around now for a long time. We've had ETFs through the tech crash in 2000, obviously through 2008. And so far, we've had an industry that keeps growing. And if anything, like you said, what tends to happen is that these sort of financial dislocations just expose the old order and kind of incentivize people to say, you know what, we were investing one particular way, or we had all our money in this particular strategy, it didn't work, and actually we're better just holding a diversified portfolio of ETFs. And this time around, I don't think it'd be any different, that people will just gravitate even more to something that's low cost and transparent and where they have choice.
I guess where I was going with it is, you know, when you have a lot of ETFs or indexes, a lot of those ETFs or indexes, and I mean more of the passive ETFs by this, there's other issues at play. There's liquidity. And I'm not saying mutual funds are better because they have similar problems. But if you look at a lot of the ETFs in the past, like ExxonMobil was in a lot of the ETFs, and Apple is in a lot of the ETFs, in large part because they're highly liquid securities. And you can't have securities in there that are not as liquid because you have the daily buying and selling of it. I mean, this kind of brings in a lot of aspects, but how do you see that impacting the ETF market moving forward?
I don't really think it has an impact, because the securities you're talking about, they're huge, you know, they're some of the largest market cap companies in America. I think where you could have an issue is, like I said, if you have small caps or micro caps, and you have a lot of assets in that particular sector. So you have companies that represent a small part of the market. And if an ETF or a mutual fund gets very large and the shareholder base becomes a big part of the shareholder base of those underlying companies, then clearly there's some liquidity concerns from that perspective. It hasn't really happened though thus far. And so, like I said, we've been through a couple of big financial crises or big events, and the industry continues to grow and the proliferation of product continues to grow, but haven't yet been these sort of circumstances where I think ETFs have sort of overpowered any particular part of the market.
You raise a good point, and this is a good segue into the gold. I remember a few years back that gold was in favor, and there was a junior gold mining index. There was a major, a gold mining index for the majors, the larger companies, and then there was a junior. Of course, juniors are the most speculative, and that's what everybody wants to bet on because they think they can win, can make hundreds and hundreds of percent return. So it's like gold on steroids, basically. And there was a point where so many people were interested, it overwhelmed the market cap, because these are tiny companies.
I mean, yeah,
you know, the juniors are really tiny. So they ended up not being a junior, ended up being a mid-cap company, because there's just so many people, they had to actually came out with a statement that said, yeah, we have to, the market cap has to be higher in order to deal with this. So your point being, like, the small and micro cap companies, that's obviously a problem, right?
Or any area of the market that's less liquid. So if you have, you know, again, ETFs are not a magic recipe for creating liquidity in an underlying market that's not liquid in the first place. And actually, the SEC brought in a rule fairly recently called the liquidity rule, which only strengthens the liquidity constraints that ETFs have. In other words, they have to, you know, invest or make investments that are more liquid than before. But yeah, I mean, they're not a magic recipe to cure underlying liquidity. So if you have an underlying part of the market that is less liquid, if you put a lot of money into that part of the market, then you could very well have issues with the liquidity. And that's why having underlying investments, whether they're stocks, whether they're bonds, whether they're commodities that are liquid, is very important.
So kind of getting into the gold market, you used to run the gold ETF, right? I mean, that's one of the, if not the largest pooled gold fund out there, correct?
Yeah, so I've been involved in gold for a number of years. Prior to Granite Shares, I was CEO of the largest gold fund in the world and started up my own company, you know, now from just over 3 years ago. But fortunately, I've been involved in gold for a long time, and it's been a fascinating experience. It's just an incredibly interesting market, and it's just as relevant today as it ever has been.
What do you think of the gold market now? I mean, obviously, it's doing well, and it's been one of the best performing asset classes as of this year so far. What do you think of that market?
I mean, I'm biased, obviously, because I personally like gold. I think everybody should own a little bit of gold in their portfolio. But, you know, look, here are the facts. I mean, gold remains the best performing asset of the 21st century. And, you know, since 2000, I'm including U.S. equities, emerging market equities, international equities, TIPS, you know, treasury bonds. And so gold has done really well, obviously, this year, but over time, it has performed well as well. Go back to 2008, and I was involved in gold through the last financial crisis. And I'm not going to say that this time around is exactly the same, because clearly, it's a very different crisis, and it's going to manifest itself in very different ways. But in 2008, you had a similar situation where you had a dislocation, a very large dislocation in the market. Gold went down initially when there was a huge liquidity crunch and people were scrambling for cash and indiscriminately sold everything in the market, including gold, to raise cash to meet margin calls and investor redemptions. But then obviously people bought gold because they were more fearful about losing money and a further dislocation than making money. And so gold went on to, depending on where you bought it, to double or triple over the next few years. You know, the conditions, remember the response. You know, the response from government was to print money, which is, you know, what's happening this time around, was to drop interest rates, which is what's happened this time around. And, you know, all of that propelled gold to an all-time high. Gold then adjusted, consolidated, and went into a bear market for a few years. And I think we've been in a bull market for gold, actually, the last 2 years, starting really 2 years ago. Now, this is the kind of gasoline that we saw 2008 putting on the gold market, which is huge amount of money printing. We've printed $2 trillion, more than we did in the financial crisis. This is the Fed. And remember, that's just been done in the last 60 days. That's just 60 days worth of work. And obviously, I'm not including all the other stimulus programs, et cetera, which take the number to much higher. So we have printed a massive, gargantuan amount of money, more than we did last time. And we've lost every single job that we gained from 2008 in the expansion of the last 12 years. And we have interest rates back at zero. In real terms, they're negative, of course, which is when you factor in inflation or take away inflation. This is the cocktail for a gold bull market. And this is something where, you know, the gold market really responds well to negative real interest rates, because obviously the opportunity cost of owning gold goes down because gold doesn't pay any kind of income. So if there's no income to be gained from cash or bonds, then the opportunity cost of gold is more favorable. And I think this is an environment where we're going to see much more money printing. We've seen more wastage, more GDP contraction than we did in 2008, which to me benefits gold. And really the only policy that governments have is to debase their currencies by printing money and enacting all sorts of stimulus programs. And historically, the direct beneficiary of that has always been gold, because gold is the currency of last resort. It's, you can't print gold, simply put.
Well, right now they can't print gold at all because they're not allowed to man the mines and the mints and all that. So
exactly.
No, that's great. I mean, gold tends to be a market that tends to attract a certain type in all seasons. There are people we call gold bugs who are always bullish in gold, and then there's people who are more rational about it. You kind of look at it in an unbiased way, and I think it's hard to argue the argument against gold right now. A, it's performing better than most other things, especially given what's gone on the last few months. And also, as you said, the underlying fundamentals support the price going up. I want to ask you one more question. We can kind of wrap it up here. You have this strategy of, you call it excluding losers. What do you mean by that?
We have a new fund. It was launched in October last year. Ticker code is XOUT. And the ticker code describes exactly what the strategy does, which is it X outs the losers. So I guess kind of going back to what we were talking about in terms of active management or traditional active management, but basically the whole industry has always been geared to this idea of picking winners. You know, we know that whether it's scientifically, whether it's through thousands and thousands of research papers and actual empirical evidence, that picking winners is just a very, very difficult thing to do and doesn't work consistently over time, especially after fees and taxes. And what we thought was, well, hang on a minute, if we reverse that philosophy, instead of thinking about picking winners, what if we just exclude the losers? In other words, is it easier to identify losers than it is to pick winners? So ask yourself the question, is it easy when you look at the market to identify a zombie company than to find the next Google? And I think for us, we thought, or we believe it's easier to identify the losers. And so XAO is a large cap U.S. equity strategy, so very similar to the broad market. It takes the 500 largest companies in the U.S. by market cap, and we X out 250, or half of them, that we believe are most vulnerable to technological disruption. In other words, those ones that are not going to thrive in this digital slash internet economy. And just to be very clear, this is not a tech fund. Absolutely not. By inverting the risk of technological disruption, your assumption is that technological disruption is affecting all companies in all sectors. So if you just focus on picking winners, chances are we all know that it's just a handful of companies that have driven the stock market performance over the long term. And most people own those companies anyway. But it's when you flip it on its head and say, well, who's going to be disrupted? Well, now you're opening up to every single sector. And those could be tech companies themselves. Tech disruption, we think, is one of the largest forward-facing risks that investors have. We think that there are a lot of companies and sectors that before the COVID crisis happened were strategically disadvantaged. But now, I think, vast areas of the economy have been laid to waste. I think that things will change kind of fundamentally from here. I don't think things will just jump back to normal. Investors have to ask themselves, you know, why own some of these companies, some of these largest companies in the market? You know, why own them at all? Why not leave them out of the portfolio? You know, especially now, you know, without credible access to the digital economy, have been exposed. And so with X out, you know, for example, we have our top 10 X outs, or top 10 danger stocks, as we call them. And they underperformed the market by 6.4% over Q1, and then 5.5%, you know, in Q4 of last year. We think that there's a real sort of science behind this. And so far, at least, we've been vindicated by the strategy outperforming the broad market pretty significantly since inception. But it's a totally new idea. No one's ever done that before. But I think intuitively, it makes sense, you know, that there are certainly, you know, within an index of 500 companies, not every company is a company you want to own. And in many ways, that's the flaw in passive investing, which is just buying every company indiscriminately of whether it's good or bad. If you have a way to exclude the bad ones, then why not exclude them?
I love the idea. It's something similar that we do with investing. It's not about beating the market. It's about not losing big when the market swan dives like it did. Yeah. The math to me is clear. If you don't lose big, you actually beat the market over the long term. You don't need to beat it year in, year out. You just need to not lose big and you'll do fine.
You know, talk about the drawdowns. And again, coming into this, if I could just sort of from a very high level, tell people how this strategy was positioned. And people will think it makes absolute sense now, but this is a model. This is pure science. There's no human input into this. It's purely rules-based. But coming into this, we were basically short banks or, you know, financial services, oil companies, and real estate, and then long healthcare and technology. You know, the model that identified financial services, energy companies, real estate as sectors that were at risk beforehand, you know, obviously, those are exactly the places you did not want to be over the last couple of months. So again, we can't say that we have a crystal ball or anything like that, you know, going forward. But I think it was a kind of very insightful in terms of thinking about how the quantitative process, you know, identifies companies, and that it had already picked these companies out. And obviously, you know, they didn't do well over the last couple of months.
I want to wrap it up here in the interest of time, but this has been great having you on, Will, because this has been really interesting for me to get into your mind since you have such a background experience in ETFs. Where can people find more about you and learn more about what you're doing with your funds and products?
Thank you, Kirk, again, for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure. Great to be on your show. For finding us, graniteshares.com, just the name as it sounds. So graniteshares, all one word, .com. I'm on Twitter at Will Rind, also LinkedIn, etc. We're pretty easy to find. So just the company Granite Shares, and our relevant sort of social handles would be either at Granite Shares or us individually.
All right. Well, that was a great interview with Will. Hope you all got a lot from that. I know I did. I really enjoyed talking to him. There's a lot of detail there that, you know, in the panel portion, we're going to dig into, because there's probably a lot of definitions that we did not hit on that might be confusing some people. So let's introduce the panelists for this week. So we have our returning panelist, Barbara Friedberg. How are you doing today, Barb?
Hi, everybody. I'm doing great. Happy to be here.
Well, good. Well, glad to have you here once again. I know you're once again stuck in your house, as we all are.
Yeah, but I got a great view out my window.
I'm glad to hear that. That is really essential right now, because that's the only outside that most of us are getting. We also have another returning panelist, Megan Gorman. How are you doing?
Hi, today, everyone, from my living room in Oakland.
Nice to have you on as well.
Thanks for having me.
And we have a special guest this week. We have a returning panelist, Miranda Marquette. How you doing today, Miranda?
I'm doing great. I really appreciate the fact that you all let me come on in and do the thing. It's so nice. So nice that you all let me come in and do the thing.
Miranda's a little spicy this week, so make it a little entertaining. And actually, we missed Cinco de Mayo. That was yesterday on the recording day. So maybe that's why Miranda's spicy. Out at the bars, Miranda?
I'm self-quarantining at home. The sad thing is I even had to do pizza last night because I was so busy that I didn't end up baking tacos. And so Taco Tuesday is Wednesday this week.
Nice. Well, we can all have our virtual Cinco de Mayo, which isn't quite the same.
We'll do our best. Exactly. We'll do our best.
So, all right. Well, let's get to it. So we had a good interview with Will, and I know there were a lot of terms here that people had talked about, that we both talked about, and we want to kind of get into that. But let's get started with ETFs versus mutual funds. That's a topic that we touched on, but I think for a lot of people, it's still confusing. And it's understandable because there's a lot of nuance to it. But Barb, you had mentioned something about this before the show. What are your thoughts? ETFs, mutual funds? Do you have kind of a preference?
Yes, I do have a preference. And ETFs are similar in composition to a mutual fund. In other words, they hold the same securities in most cases, the same stocks and bonds, and they have a variety of different styles. The difference is ETFs, you can buy and sell during the day, just like a regular stock on the stock market, whereas mutual funds trade only once a day, at the end of the day. ETFs I like because they're convenient and the fees are typically lower than mutual funds. Although, as Will mentioned, some 401k plans only allow you to have mutual funds. So obviously in that case, if that's like your 401k, well, then you're going to invest in mutual funds. But for the reasons that they're easier to trade and the fees are typically lower, I do prefer ETFs.
Miranda, what about you? You're big on passive investing, and do you have a preference, or if it's the same as Barb's, is there a reason people would choose mutual funds over ETFs?
Same thing. I actually prefer the ETFs. They trade like stocks and exchange. Also, because I'm big into robo-advisors, that's what I have to work with. Let's be honest. When you use robo-advisors, that's what you're going to end up with. You will end up with ETFs because most robo-advisors use those to construct their portfolios. A lot of the time, their fees are lower than even index funds. You're going to see lower expense ratios and things like that. So yeah, I just like them. They're easy to use. They're easy to manage. If you're doing asset allocation, it's really easy to rebalance your portfolio. So yeah, there's just a lot of reasons I like ETFs, despite some of the problems that you might see with them. But for the most part, I like them.
Well, what would be some of the problems since you kind of mentioned that, Miranda?
Well, it depends on what you're investing in, right? I mean, one of the things you have to realize is one of the biggest difference between ETFs and mutual funds is that with a mutual fund, you actually own a little bit of everything in that fund, right? You actually own the underlying assets. With an ETF, you do not. With an ETF, you don't own the underlying assets. You own a share of this bundled unit of underlying shares. So you don't actually own the shares themselves. So it's important to realize that with an ETF, you don't actually own the underlying investments, and with a mutual fund, you do. And some people prefer the mutual fund because they actually own that slice of each thing in there.
Megan, what are your thoughts? You manage portfolios. You probably have a pretty strong opinion on this.
I like both mutual funds and ETFs. I think they each play a role. Barb and Miranda have hit on sort of the benefits of ETFs. I do think it's important to also always put a tax lens on this. And I think one of the biggest things that most people find is that mutual funds are more tax inefficient than ETFs. Now, it's not all the times, but typically, you know, mutual funds, the way they operate is the managers are buying and trading all the time. And it doesn't mean that they're actually passing through the gains to you unless they decide to do a distribution. And so I will tell you, at times, mutual funds can be very tax inefficient. Someone who does tax returns, I will tell you where people get surprised again and again is they have a very large mutual fund distribution that they didn't know was coming. And that can cause their tax planning to go awry. So that, to me, is one of the big things to be cognizant of. But I'm a big fan of both mutual funds and ETFs because I think that they each have specific roles to play. Now, in the current volatile marketplace, I will tell you strategically, we have made decisions to do a lot more of our day-to-day trading in ETFs, partly because we're trying to take advantage of certain things in the marketplace. But, you know, we use mutual funds as well. But I think when you have a market that's going through the volatility that we're in today, and you want to take advantage of a certain moment in the market, an ETF is a great choice to do so.
I want to play a little devil's advocate because I think the point that actually Megan just made was really important with the tax implications. Because if you think about it, in a normal environment, you're probably going to be somewhat aware of what the tax implications are. Generally speaking, it's going to be kind of what you expect. They buy and sell. But if you think about it in times of distress, so if the market sells off and they end up selling a lot of securities, at the end of the year, that could be a good or a bad thing. Because if you think about 2008, there might have been a lot of losses that are able to be carried forward over time. And that could be beneficial from a tax perspective. Now, it doesn't happen every day, but depending on what the market's doing and what their portfolio is doing, if there's a lot of turnover, that could have tax implications. Just for reference, I actually do use ETFs. But I'm going to say this about mutual funds because no one else does. The nice part about mutual funds is with ETFs, they tend to be more index-based or passive. Most of them are. And one of the challenges of ETFs is there needs to be liquidity in the underlying securities. If you're investing in a, just say like the S&P 500 index, it's pretty much you know what you're going to get. But if you're investing in, good example, there was a junior miner ETF that had to no longer invest in juniors. They had to invest in mid-sized companies because too much money was in there. There might be some where their securities aren't liquid enough so they can't buy them because they have to be very liquid. So the one nice part about mutual funds is if you have a good manager and they're buying, let's say, value in some securities that are maybe not as liquid, they can strategically buy those securities. Whereas an ETF, if it's not liquid enough, it may not make sense. There are some benefits. I would argue there's probably fewer benefits for mutual funds, but there are some that if, depending on what your style is, you may want to consider mutual funds versus an ETF for that. But I want to get into the active versus passive here as well, because that's obviously plays a part into this. I know, Miranda, you're passive, but you haven't been on the show in a few episodes. So let's talk about you take a passive approach to investing versus the active. Why do you do that?
Because I'm lazy. Basically, it comes down to I really subscribe to that whole Nobel Prize winning asset allocation work on portfolio theory that says, you know, your asset allocation matters more than what you're actually investing in. And that works for long-term investing. Now, I know that with things like alternative investments and with strategic and tactical portfolio management, you can avoid the worst parts of downturns. You don't have to worry about writing it out. I really like a simple approach that just allows me to meet my financial goals and help me live my lifestyle goals. So I'm just kind of fine going along with that. And if the market falls and I have to ride it out, I'm young enough to be able to ride it out. It all just kind of melds together to work really well for my style, my investing needs, and the fact that, yeah, I've got other things I want to do in my life than try and research PE ratios or try and figure out a tactical asset allocation or a tactical investment portfolio. So there's just a lot of things that I just like about this passive approach because it allows me to meet all my goals and I don't have to worry about whether I'm beating the market or not because I don't care. It's just a very simple approach and I like it. It works for me. So that's just kind of why I do it because it works really well for me.
I have to say, I feel like I'm making progress with Miranda because she's actually mentioned tactical by name. I think that might have been the first time I ever heard that.
So. I mean, yeah, it works for people and you all do a good job with it. I mean, it's great when it works for people, it works for people. I mean, the way I figure it is in the end, when the zombie apocalypse comes and everything crashes and nothing recovers in the end, we'll have bigger problems. And it doesn't matter whether you were passive or tactical or active or whatever. It's not going to matter because if we have a full-on economic collapse, what's going to matter is my fishing tackle, my guns, and my food storage.
Yeah, well, as long as you have your cave, your guns, and your gold and MREs, you'll be okay, and fishing tackle.
Well, the gold's not even that important because who's going to want my gold? When you're in a complete economic collapse, gold is just as useless as anything else. Like, do I want something shiny or do I want something I can eat?
I agree with that. I say that in part in jest because, you know, if you really look at economic collapses, food is what's important and the simple things in life. But people don't talk about that, but they're not selling you food. So they're selling you the gold. So Megan, what are your thoughts on an active versus passive? I know you're more of a take kind of a blended approach, right?
Yeah, we do take a blended approach. I think all of us, as Miranda points out, has to find their comfort zone with their portfolio. One of the things when you think about indexing in particular that I always remind clients, when you index, you're going to hug the benchmark and there's nothing wrong with that at all. But it means you're not going to see significant outperformance at certain intervals. And so a lot of investors are very comfortable with that. And I think it's important to know if you are. When we do a mix of, you know, what I would call sort of more of a core satellite approach, part of it has to do with making sure we're not taking on any unintended risks in certain asset classes. So in terms of indexing, large cap's a great space for that. But where we get to be a little bit more focused on having active management is when we look at asset classes, for example, like emerging markets. And that's because part of my role when you're engaged with someone like me is we're doing deeper dives into what the portfolio is holding. And so, for example, one thing, and this is pre-COVID, but one thing that we often focus on is our allocation to certain countries. And so when we have people indexing, they may have more exposure to a country like China than they might intentionally want. And so that's where we would then look for active management. That doesn't mean it's the right answer for everyone, but my role in this a lot of the time is to look for unintended risk and help mitigate it. Now, most of the time, it's not going to be that big of a deal, but it is something to bring up. The other time we've looked towards active management, particularly in spaces like large cap, is when we've had a significant run up in the markets. So over the past, before COVID, you know, over the past 18 months before then, we had spent a lot of time sticking to our knitting, trimming positions, and moving gains in the equity space back into fixed income. And it was really hard for a lot of clients to do that. While we were doing that, we also focused on the fact that there are certain managers in the large cap space that are concentrated, that in down markets still go down, but don't drop as much as the indices do. And so for a lot of our clients, we were able to move a couple of percentage of their holdings to those managers as a backstop. I will tell you, in this market, it has helped. But part of that is when you are managing someone's financial life and their portfolio, you're running performance. So you're actually seeing it in real time, what's stepping in and what's actually working as the markets go through these reverberations. But that approach, I just want to emphasize, is not the right approach for everybody. You have to want to be in that approach. And I think how Miranda runs her portfolios, and I think if I understand how Barb does, I think that they're great approaches as well.
It's really important that people are comfortable with their approach. And I think all of us have seen a lot over the years. I mean, there's a lot of different strategies people use. I mean, there are definitely wrong strategies. But there are so many correct strategies, and it really has to align with the way that you think, or you know, the investment manager that you're using or advisor, that person has to be aligned with the way they think. So there needs to be some alignment, because some people are passive, some people are active, some people are day traders. I mean, there's so many different types of approaches, and you can't say it's right or wrong. It's just whether it's right or wrong for you. So I think it's great to look at it from that lens. Barb, what about you in terms of active versus passive? How do you look at the...
Well, I'd like to step in first and just clear up some terms, just in case some of our listeners don't know what active and passive means. And also want to just get back and say what liquidity is, so that our listeners understand liquidity. And just quick definition, that means that the shares are bought and sold a lot during the day, and they're easy to trade. Big companies, easy to trade, everybody's buying and selling them. Some obscure bond would be considered non-liquid or less liquid because there's not a lot of people buying and selling them. That's liquidity. Okay, active and passive. Passive investing is a theory that was made possible because long-term research has shown, and actually Will, our guest, referenced this, that stock picking is very difficult to beat the overall market in general. And we call the overall market an index. And there's several different types of indexes that we can slice and dice. The most common is the Standard & Poor's 500, which includes 500 of the most important companies, or the Dow Jones, which includes 30. So passive investing typically means buying an index and holding it. And that strategy has proven to match the market. And over the long term, the market has earned 9% a year over the last 100 plus years. So if you're comfortable with that, then go with the passive. Now, that doesn't guarantee anything in the future. I want to just say that right out. There will be periods where you'll lose money. Active investing is where a manager tries to beat the market using different strategies. Some managers are successful for that, using active strategies. The problem is you're not sure if they're successful because of luck or because of skill. An active manager might be successful 1 year, and or even 10 years, like Bill Gross was a fabulous bond manager. He was successful for many, many years until he wasn't. So that being said, yes, I typically adhere to a passive indexing approach because I go with the research. Where I deviate is when passive means you pretty much buy and hold. When markets go down, I'm going to buy more. So that makes me a little more active. Additionally, I parcel out my particular allocations to different indexes in a way that might be unique to me. So I have a certain amount of large cap index funds. I have some value index funds. I have some international stock index funds. And so there are a lot of different varieties of types of indexes you can buy.
I agree with these approaches. I think personally, I mean, we look at, in some ways, passive for things like large cap, which is really hard. I mean, there's a lot of large cap managers and it's really hard for them to add value. Then there's some other areas. There's some interesting areas I've heard over time. It's more the approach is different. For an example, the way one person describes is they call them owner operators. So companies that are largely owned by a single person. Historically, if you look back, they tend to do better than companies that have very low ownership by the person running the company, but they're not as liquid. And so it's hard to put those into broad-based funds so they don't get priced the same way. But a strategy like that is different, and it's probably a little bit hard to do in an ETF or a mutual. Well, you could probably do it in a mutual fund structure, but an ETF structure would be a little bit hard. So things like that, or some managers might do like internationals and as you know, sometimes it's really hard to get good data on certain markets in certain countries. So I think it's not a binary approach, but I think there's definitely some, depending on what approach you want, you just need to be mindful of what's the best way to approach that.
Kirk, I want to chime in just one more second. And actually, I want to feed on a little bit about what you said and about what Megan said, which is there are certain markets, absolutely, where it is really that are less transparent and where an active manager really can add some value. And like you said, there are some international markets where it might be better to go with an active manager, like emerging markets, which are smaller countries where they have the resources to go in and really examine those individual companies. And I also wanted to mention the X Out ETF fund that was mentioned during the regular part of the show. And I thought this was a fascinating approach where he actually is going to not try and pick winners, but weed out losers. And it's a new fund, so it'll, you know, how it performs really has yet to be given any long-term perspective. But I thought that was an interesting and new approach. Whether it outperforms the indexes or not, we will not know for a couple of years.
I like approaches that take a different perspective to the markets, because I think most people look at it the same way. Everyone reads the same stuff. They're looking at the same data. And most people use the same assumptions. And this is one thing that we look at things a little bit differently because, you know, I find that looking at it through a different lens, you can see things that other people can't see. I'm with you, Barb, like let's let time play out and see how it does. But I like the fact that he's looking at it differently. And instead of saying, let's pick winners, let's remove the losers, which is another way to look at it, but maybe that's more effective. It's like how we look at it. We're not trying to beat the market. We're just trying not to lose big. And if you don't lose big, you effectively beat the market over a cycle. That's kind of our approach. And that's why we're a little bit different. I love the approach. And you also mentioned something I wanted to hit on too, which is really important, is in the US, we have certain standards that everyone kind of agrees on. And in terms of how they value companies. But if you look at internationally, those standards don't necessarily apply. Because in part, because of the lack of transparency. So if you go to the US versus France versus Japan versus Singapore, and then you look at some really emerging markets, or India is a good example. Like it's just a different type of market. It's not good or bad. It's just you need to understand how to look at things and price them. Because if you're trying to base it on earnings, and actually Greece is another example of this, if you're trying to base it on earnings, you might completely miss the ball because the way they calculate earnings is different. Maybe you want to use like price to sales or price to book, and the accounting in some of these countries is different, or the way they approach it. So you can't just look at it through the US lens. You have to look at it at a lens that's appropriate for that country or market. Because as you said, Barb, some cases there's a lack of information or transparency, or just maybe their accounting is a little bit different. So I think it's really important to just understand that. So you're not looking at it saying, well, I don't understand. Why is Russia have a CAPE ratio of 5? You know, why don't I invest in Russia? Maybe things are a little bit different over there, which I think we all would understand. So this gets into the topic also that we were talking about in the interview with Smart Beta. So we have our resident expert on financial terms is Barbara Friedberg. You have thoughts on Smart Beta, Barb?
I do. We've talked about indexing, and that's simply just buying a group of stocks or bonds that fit in with a predetermined index. And these are bought in the percentages of what is called a market capitalization weight, which in simple terms means the bigger companies get a heavier weighting. Smart Beta is a twist in that it indexes, but not according to the typical way. It will choose certain factors and certain parameters within which to invest. So, for example, a Smart Beta fund might just look at dividends and choose of the S&P 500, the highest dividend paying stocks. And so you might call that a Smart Beta dividend fund. And they go through all different types of factors that play out in investing. So it might be looking at revenue and choosing all of the stocks that have a certain revenue growth metric. So any stock that is growing above 10% a year might be included in that smart beta fund. So it's a catch-all term for a tweak on regular indexing. And there's a belief that you're going to factor in valuations. So better, cheaper valued, or more fairly valued stocks will be more popular in a smart beta strategy. WisdomTree Investing is one of the companies that focuses on smart beta investing, but many companies have smart beta products.
Just for reference, Barb, like the major indexes like the S&P and the Dow, how are those calculated? Are those based on price or market cap, or how do they do it?
They're based on market cap and they use a formula. And market cap means the number of shares outstanding by the price of those shares. So if a stock has really gotten ratcheted up at price, it's going to have a very high market cap. And so it will be weighted. You'll own a lot more of Apple than you will of Kodak in your S&P 500 fund. For example, one type of smart beta is equal weight. And an equal weight smart beta fund will just, instead of weighting the companies within the fund via market cap, they weight them all equally. So you have the same weight of Kodak as you do of Apple.
One of the things that I think really kind of brought this to the surface is certainly, you know, all you math geeks in the audience will kind of love this topic. But, you know, if you look at indexing and it's based on, most of them are based on market cap, some of them are based on price, and it generally can skew the, you know, the index. Companies start trying to manipulate that by, see these companies that are trading for thousands of dollars a share. Well, back in the 90s, they would just do splits, and people love splits because they think they've got more shares. Splits were somewhat attractive back then, even though really mathematically didn't make a difference. But it allowed people to get in for less money. So if it was $1,000 a share, somebody with $500 couldn't invest in it. So the splits were attractive decades ago. But there are a lot of companies now that are trading for $1,000, $2,000 a share, or Berkshire, which has never done a split. And sometimes that can play into the indexes in a manipulative sort of way. I'm not saying the companies are manipulating it, but they're seeing the benefit of doing that because they can get more interest from the indexes. So I think a lot of these new strategies, what's interesting is they're trying to look at it from a different angle and saying, all right, this approach doesn't make sense because you're not getting the most attractive companies. You're getting a big company, which you may not want in the index in such a large fashion. In some ways, you can look at this as kind of a positive reinforcement loop. You think about Apple, we'll just name all the big ones, you know, the FANG stocks, let's say, which, you know, tend to be some of the larger, or FANG M now. Some of those are some of the largest companies out there. So if they're in an index, they're going to get more people buying those shares, which is going to boost the stock price up. Well, the stock price goes up, that equals higher market cap. Market cap goes up, all of a sudden, now the index is going up. Well, the index is going up, more people are going to invest, which is going to allow them to boost their price up even more. So it's this positive reinforcement loop. As long as the markets are going up, it keeps reinforcing that these companies, the larger companies, get bigger and bigger and bigger, which maybe an equal weight might be more appropriate. But the fact that people are looking at alternate ways, I think, is really interesting to me because it just shows that people are actually trying to think outside the box and not just go along with it because it exists. It's nice to look into. It's a trend. Who knows how long it's going to go on, but at least it's a current trend. Let's kind of pick one more topic and then we can kind of wrap it up here. So, you know, when people are looking at like, should I do an index approach, or Will had mentioned quant or algo trading, kind of gets into this, in a sense, kind of stock picking, if you will. So Miranda, what are your thoughts on the concept of, I mean, you may not want to get into the quant versus algo trading, but the stock picking versus passive. How do you look at that? I mean, I know you mentioned earlier that you were looking at the economists who did the research back then and how that played out.
I really don't do a lot of stock picking. I occasionally will choose some ETFs that like aren't included with the passive strategy or with the asset allocation. Like we were talking about actually before the show, you know, a few weeks ago, oil took a dive. So I went ahead and picked up a couple oil ETFs at a super low price, and they're doing really well right now. So, you know, one feels like a genius, even though one is not. You do have to be careful. That's the problem with any sort of active strategy or any sort of stock picking strategy, is that sometimes the market conditions make things go higher. And when that happens, you feel like you're a genius and that you, and to a certain extent, yeah, like you can see some of those trends, you can pick some good stuff and you can move forward with it. But for the most part, it really didn't take a genius for me to go, well, I think I'm going to spend a little bit of money on some oil ETFs. And if those ETFs go bust, then, you know, then I lose the money. Whatever, but because I didn't spend any sort of money that was I needed. So when I do things like that, that are out of the ordinary, that are a little extra, I make sure it's money I can definitely afford to lose and money I know I'm not going to need. So really kind of look at it that way, because, you know, sure, I feel like a genius right now, but am I going to feel like a genius the next time oil prices tank? We'll see.
And actually, for reference, we were talking about this before the show with oil. And if you guys don't remember, oil was down to like negative $35 in the futures market. So if you want to talk about how markets are inefficient, that might be one example. But what's interesting is we were talking about before the show, that ETF that Miranda was referencing, I think right now it's down about 4.5%. And the futures markets in oil is down around 6%. I only mention that because they're supposed to be investing in the same thing. And yet there's a big discrepancy in movements of price. So just because it's in an ETF doesn't mean it's accurately reflecting what the actual price is. This applies especially for commodities or ETNs, as we referred to in the show, also another one that isn't necessarily accurately tracking the price movements. Another one is also leveraged ETFs, which tend not to accurately reflect their price movements. They're supposed to on a day-to-day basis, but on a long-term basis, they tend to not reflect the prices in the same way. Megan, what are your thoughts here on algo trading, quant trading, active stock picking? Where do you kind of come down in that conversation?
Can you clarify the question a bit more?
I was just trying to leave it open. But basically, a lot of people say, well, you can't outperform the market by picking stocks, but yet some people do. So there's a lot of money, time and money that's gone into quantitative approaches, algo trading. Some people do tend to beat the market, but what's your thesis behind this? Like, is it worth trying to beat the market? Are there ways that people should consider, or how should people look at that?
It's really important for people to build a portfolio that they can be intellectually interested in. I say that because people spend a lot of time on how they manage their money. I think that a lot of good things have happened over the past decade with fee compression, with ETFs becoming far more common in portfolios. What I think that most people need to focus on is that, look, your goal is to construct a portfolio that on an annualized basis will deliver a certain return. And it might not be that same return every year, but on an annualized basis, it is. And that's because the point of having a portfolio is to create an asset base that ultimately can support you in retirement. So when I'm focusing on the portfolio construction, I'm very clear with clients that, look, not every quarter is going to be a winner. But we want to be participating in the market. We want to be doing it in an efficient manner. We want to be cost effective and we want to get you exposure. But most of all, if we're targeting over the long term to have an annualized rate of return of 6.3%, and we've built all of your retirement models assuming that you get to that 6.3% on an annualized basis, are we on path? Are we following strategy? Are we going to get you to a point where you would be able to retire and walk away and continue to grow your assets at a pace in which you can support yourself? To me, that's the bigger piece of this, is tying the financial planning to what the portfolio is doing.
That's a great perspective, Megan. Barb, what are your thoughts on this? I know you're kind of getting to the weeds with this.
Algorithmic trading is pretty much programming a computer to buy and sell based on certain predetermined factors. It's extremely popular today. And as Will mentioned, that's one of the reasons it's really hard for individual stock pickers to beat the market. I think Megan stated the idea of investing very, very clearly. We sometimes get so caught up in strategies and approaches when the goal is really making your money work for you for the long term. So you have money to spend now and you have money to spend later. And investing is only a tool that is going to help you reach your financial goals. Whatever strategy you choose, make sure that it is well thought out. It has a reasonable likelihood of success to help you meet your goals. I like robo-advisors for many different classes of investors because they offer investment management based on sensible approaches for low fees. But I also like financial advisors for many people, although many robo-advisors do have financial advisors. I like financial advisors because they have a variety of different strategies and they have the personal touch. And then DIY investors can do it on their own as well. So that's a long-winded answer to a short question, which is figure out what you want and then figure out the strategy that works best for you.
We're going to wrap it up here in the interest of time. So Miranda, where can people find more about you?
I am at MirandaMarquette.com. As always, I have a money resources page where I share the tools that I use to actually manage my money in a way that allows me to live the lifestyle I want. So you can head over to MirandaMarquette.com. I'm also on the Twitter at MMarquette and on Facebook at Planting Money Seeds.
Megan, what about you? Where can people find more about you?
Sure. People can find me on Twitter at Wealth Intersect, or you can even come to my Forbes site, which is www.forbes.com/Megan Gorman, because writing a lot of articles right now about PPP and what people are doing during the COVID-19 crisis. Thanks for having me on, Kirk.
Thanks for coming on, Megan. Barb, what about you? Where can people find more about you?
My name is Barbara Friedberg, and you can find me at Robo Advisor Pros, where I cover the robo investing field, or you can find me at BarbaraFriedbergPersonalFinance.com or everywhere else on Twitter, LinkedIn, etc. Thanks for having me, Kirk, and happy investing to everybody.
Thank you all for coming on the show. This has been a really fun one for us. So just to leave off the show, my name is Kirk Chisholm, wealth manager at Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. So that's the show for this week. Thanks again for joining us in Money Tree Investing Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can also check out our show notes at moneytreepodcast.com. On the website, you'll have access to all our resources, show notes, as well as the archive shows. Last, please leave a show rating and comments on the podcast app of your choice. When you subscribe and rate the show, it allows us to get better access to some of the top guests. We've got a lot of great guests coming up, and we're getting that from all of you who are rating and commenting on the show. So thank you all for that. So have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.